This evening, I wanted to talk about some of what we're currently facing in the world and some of what the Buddha has offered that might be of use in working with that. Currently, in our local and state and national and global environment, some of the things we're up against or that are happening. COVID-19 spreading here. Spreading globally. And at least here in the US, I don't know so much about other countries, but here in the US, it's become a political issue now. Here in the US, and more locally on the state and even Bay Area level, and in our towns, systemic racism and police violence. I think most people think racism is a bad thing, but there are huge disagreements about what appropriate action is and how to get to greater justice or what needs to happen, or, there's often a lot of disagreement around that. Protests, I think those are slowing down some, but there's still, it's pretty strong. People are wanting change and going out to the streets to demand it. And there seems to be a lot of ongoing discussion and exploration of what next steps might be, whether that's here locally or on a larger national level. Removing statues, removing names from things, looking at legal steps to restore rights, reparations for Black people. I think overall there's an atmosphere of significant divisiveness and finger pointing from people on different sides of the political spectrum. And then we have our formal meditation practice. It has great usefulness in developing calm, a really powerful deepening of the ability to be with experience and helping us increase wisdom. And yet it doesn't directly address the outer world. It doesn't really get at that. And we spend a lot of time doing in the world, a lot of time working with the world. And so that's really what I want to talk about this evening. So when it comes to taking action in the world around something like social justice, what did the Buddha say? I was on a retreat last year with Venerable Anālaya, and somebody asked him this question. One of the teacher trainees in the current Spirit Rock teacher training program asked him about that. What did the Buddha say about social justice? And he said that there just really wasn't much. I have heard of one story in a One Piece where a king asked how to keep his kingdom peaceful, and I think, if I'm remembering this correctly, that the Buddha said that the people of the kingdom should be paid well and paid fairly. I also think that, for example, the setting up the monastic order. During a time of the caste system, for the monastic order to be set up, that to be for seniority to be established exclusively based on when you ordained, was a pretty radical thing for the time. I also know it took a lot to get the Buddha to allow women to be ordained. And for the last few thousand years, women have continued to be treated differently and often worse than ordained men. So I know that's part of the equation there too. But so anyway, Venerable Anālaya said that with it being the case that the Buddha largely did not speak directly to issues of social justice, then when we aim for social justice, and he's very big on climate change in particular, and also diversity, equity, and inclusion. So when we aim for social justice, for making change, we want to work in a way where we are on a kind of continual basis reducing the defilements of mind, so that we're rubbing away that stone. We're smoothing out those edges there. The defilements are said to be totally eradicated at different stages of enlightenment. I have not gotten to any of those stages of enlightenment yet. However, some good news for all of us is that we can all work and actively engage to lessen those, slowly lessening them and lessening them, lessening our harm in the world. And also progressively, as we're lessening harm, we're increasing our kindness, our compassion, our generosity, our wisdom. So we can do that. That's part of the path. And while the Buddha may not have spoken to social justice directly, or at least in that term or those terms, the Noble Eightfold Path clearly includes the outer world. The Noble Eightfold Path is not just about time spent on the rug, right? Or sitting or in formal meditation practice. The third of the path is sila, right? Right speech, right action, right livelihood. How we're engaging with the world, right? So looking at that. So how do we respond skillfully? I want to read a bit from one of the discourses. This is Majjhima Nikaya number 7, the Vatupama Sutta, the simile of the claw. And the Buddha is at Savatthi in Jetta's Grove and Anuttapindika's Park. And he says, monastics, suppose a cloth were defiled and stained, and a dyer dipped it in some dye or another, whether blue or yellow or red or pink. It would look poorly dyed and impure in color. Why is that? Because of the impurity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is defiled, an unhappy destination may be expected. Okay, now when he's saying unhappy destination, he's saying that if we continue in this way throughout our lifetime, that unhappy destination, that's going to have to do with where we might be reborn. But so then he goes on, what, monastics, are the imperfections that defile the mind? What are these defilements? Covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Ill will is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Anger, resentment, contempt, insolence, envy, avarice, deceit, fraud. There's 16 of them. Obstinacy, rivalry, conceit, arrogance, vanity, and negligence. It's a pretty lengthy list of ways where we can fall aside, fall astray. So it really comes back to that cloth, right? And if we think of our mind, and when I say mind, I want to make sure we're including the heart as well. When we think of that, our own mind and heart, we want to be working to purify that. So the Buddha continues, knowing that covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind, a monastic abandons it. And then knowing that ill will is an imperfection that defiles the mind, a monastic abandons it, and so on and so forth with each of these 16. You know, we also point, or a common place in the Buddhist teachings where I hear about the word abandoning is in the second noble truth, right? So, which is the cause of dukkha. The cause of dukkha is craving, And our task, our duty with that is to abandon it. So our duty with these defilements is to abandon them too. There are 16 of them, but they fit into some pretty familiar buckets. Yeah, I'm sure you can guess. The buckets of greed, hatred, and delusion, right? We know about these. So what does abandoning mean to us? How possible is that for any of us? I don't know if anybody wants to speak. I could either treat it as a rhetorical question, or I could take, if people want to respond, either way. So I have a, oh, Mary, you want to say? Please speak.
For me, many times, it is, I guess Gil Fronstad was talking about it, how you can hold on to something and you're like grasping, but you can just do this. It's like you don't have to drop it or throw it away. You can just let go of the grasping. And I remind myself when I'm feeling that, is that every time I let it go, I'm creating a new kind of neural pathway. I'm 71 years old, and years of this behavior are there. And every time I can just let it go, even if it comes back and I do it again, each time I remember to do that, is to just do that. My feet are on the path. And I can kind of like, you know, go, okay, sweetheart, you're giving it your best shot.
Absolutely. And that is actually a very skillful understanding of the Buddhist teachings, as insofar as I understand them, that in each moment we have that opportunity to kind of turn the mind away from the unwholesome and toward the wholesome. We can always try to abandon something. And then what happens is outside of our control, right? Oftentimes we can abandon something if only for a moment. But I think sometimes we think that we have to be able to give it up forever and for good, and we give up because we can't do that. But it's really, the Buddha was talking about this moment, and can we give it up in this moment? We can attempt to. And then that is the practice, or certainly a significant half of the practice of right effort, right? When an unwholesome state of mind has arisen, or one quarter of the practice of right effort, when an unwholesome state of mind has arisen, we abandon it, we let go of it, we move away from it, only for this moment. If it comes back, it comes back. It's happening due to causes and conditions. Sometimes we can have no felt sense of the abandoning. It just feels like there's no way, we're too caught in it. And when that's the case, then we pay attention until it lets go. That'll happen. In this discourse, the Buddha says that when we abandon the defilements, our confidence in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha gets stronger and stronger. Becomes perfected. And when one has given up, expelled, released, abandoned, and relinquished these imperfections of the mind, these defilements, in part, they consider thus, I am possessed of perfect confidence in the Buddha, and they gain inspiration in the meaning, gain inspiration in the Dhamma, gain gladness connected with the Dhamma. So once we start to hear gladness in there, this is often, gladness is a step in this path towards the deepening of insight. So let that be a clue as well. When that gladness, when joy arises, when happiness arises, and with this gladness, when that person is glad, rapture is born in them. In one who is rapturous, the body becomes tranquil. One whose body is tranquil feels pleasure. In one who feels pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated, right? The mind settles. The heart feels more at ease. The mind gathers and collects. Interesting, it's just coming to me now. I didn't have this written in my notes to speak about, but Venerable Anallio, he said that when he learned about concentration, and if you have any interest in this, I'm going to be showing something, so you may want to look now, but you don't have to at all. But what he said is when he heard concentration, he thought of it as get everything out of the way and go like this. And that what he learned about concentration is that, no, it's like this. It's like an embrace. Everything gets folded in. Nothing is excluded. So I just thought that's a nice image. Okay. So what the Buddha is talking about here is this, as we kind of polish the stone, right? The stone of our life in that rock tumbler of daily life, then that can really feed towards these wholesome states of mind. It can develop more joy, and then from that that rapture, the gladness, the pleasure, and that leads towards awakening. So that is the wholesome, skillful mind states that come. So this is our opportunity. And with any kind of development on the path, there are ways we get in our own way of continuing to deepen, of continuing to practice. Anybody get in your own way on occasion? Okay, all right. So one way that we do that, not starting where we are. Right? Philip often talks about start where you are, right? And sometimes when I read about something like in this discourse about uprooting the defilements and gaining perfect confidence in the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, I can sometimes feel like it's not a particularly possible task, or doesn't feel like it's within reach. So why get started? Oh, what else are we going to do? You know, we're here, we're living. You know, as Philip has said before, how long does it take? As long as it takes. You know, and you can use that for anything. Dana De Palma, who I've been working with in the Nine Bodies Teacher Training, she says, we're playing the long game. Yeah. Actually, she says, we're playing the long game, sweetheart, as she's trying to soothe the ego. We're playing the long game, sweetheart. Yeah. Starting where we are means being open to our experience as it is, that this is what the conditions of our life are like in this moment. That's what that means. Whether it is, you know, that it's like this as opposed to some perceived ideal of how it should be. Right. So whether it's we want to learn Spanish, we want to learn to play the saxophone, we want to heal from our surgery, or we want to end racism or bring about significant social change in the world. We want to start over and over again. Just start right here, over and over and over. And that can really take humility. Another great quality to develop on the path. Sometimes it's helpful to see, do we have an unacknowledged demand? Do we have some kind of hidden demand that it happened in a certain time frame? Right? Sometimes start where you are. It seems like an affront. You know, I know people who are like, well, I could have started meditation, but, you know, it takes years to develop that way. Well, if it takes years, then start now. And in years, you'll have years of practice under your belt. So we can do this with ourselves in different ways. not getting started with practice, rejecting the fact that our body isn't healing faster, that our partner's body isn't healing faster, whatever it is. Not learning whatever it is that we want to learn because we have, we're caught in some future goal, right? We're caught in it. We have to be at this level by this point in time rather than just engaging with it right now. Another way that we can get, can stumble on the path. Are we caught in a concept or an idea of how a given experience, or our progress on the path should look? I find that this is another big one. I've known many people, and certainly I am in this category, who have discounted certain experiences because of an idea that they had about what the experience should be. And if we're always measuring our experience against these concepts of what experience should be like, then we're not actually here with the actual experience as it is. The felt experience is so much more valuable than trying to reach this concept of something else. Really, I really want to point you towards that. That's something that's just become really so clear to me in this recent practice period that I've been in. Yeah, so just continuing to go to the direct experience, the felt sense, and let that be our guide. This is enough. Yeah, we can be easily satisfied with just this amount that's here right now. Just turning over and over to know our experience. What is this experience like right now? And you can do this with anything. You can do this standing in line at the supermarket. What is the experience of impatience like? What is the experience of anxiety or fear as somebody comes close to our 6-foot bubble? You know, all of these kinds of things. On Venerable Analio, on this same retreat that I did last year, it was the mindfulness of breathing retreat. And those of you who are familiar with the discourse on mindfulness of breathing, there are these 16 steps that you go through in this systematic sequence. And you start out by breathing in and out long, and then breathing in and out short, and so on and so forth, all the way up to kind of this complete letting go, seeing through the three characteristics, all of this kind of stuff, right? And one of these steps along the way is breathing in, they know joy. Breathing out, they know joy. And I had a little bit of intimidation, like, oh, what if I can't feel the joy? And he just says, even just a little bit of joy is enough for us. Just such kindness, such compassion in that attitude. And that really allowed me, it's like, oh, sure, there's a hint of joy here. Yeah, you know, I don't have to manufacture anything. I can just be with that little hint there. We can also get caught in measuring our progress over too short a term. And when I think of that, I think of that hearing about when the Dalai Lama was at Spirit Rock in the early 2000s. I think they were doing some retreat with Buddhist teachers. He was there for that. And they had a meeting with, he met with staff, with all the Spirit Rock staff. And apparently there's a person there who said they've been practicing for a long time and they do these retreats, but they just don't see the progress. And the Buddha was, His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, was talking back and forth with his translator. And then he turns back and he shakes his head. And he says, yes, I know exactly what you mean. Imagine that. His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. Somebody says they can't see practice, they can't see progress in their own development. He says, I know exactly what you mean. But when I look back over the decades of practice, 10, 20, 30 years, then I can see that I have developed. Huh. How do you like that? You know, that really recasts that So often I think we use that, am I getting progress on the path, as a way to judge ourselves, and as if we know what that progress is going to look like, and as if we know what time frame it's going to happen on. Another thing that I think can really hinder our practice is compartmentalizing things. Thinking that, you know, I do my formal meditation practice, I pay attention to the breath, and, you know, I do my metta practice regularly. But seeing it really kind of once we get up off the cushion, we kind of forget about it. Yeah. One monk I heard giving a talk once, he says that meditation, the formal meditation isn't, he says, that's not practice. That's preparation. Going out into the world, that's practice. Yeah. So a very different frame there. That's what we're practicing for. Look, I wish you all deep meditative experiences. And to the extent that you can carry your practice into the world, into your daily life and throughout your daily life, interweave it with all the moments, or, you know, more and more moments of your daily life, to that extent, the practice will can deepen more and more. You know, we're spending only so much time a day in formal practice. So as we start to move into action in the world, there are also useful tools that you're already familiar with that will help you in this work. So there are some very useful supporting mental factors. And then I'm going to talk about some other practices. So number one, you've heard of this one before, mindfulness. Yeah, that receptive, non-judgmental knowing of experience, that receptivity, that feminine quality. And Philip, Jack, other teachers also bring in this, I can't remember, one of them uses like loving awareness or something like that. So bringing this hint of kindness, of compassion to it. It's not a dry, sterile thing, okay? It's that being receptive, opening up. And it is non-judgmental, right? And it's quite remarkable because it can hold judgmentalness, can hold judgment without judgment. It can hold hatred without judgment, without aversion of the hatred. It can hold that so that we can know that. And as we know something like aversion, like judgment, as we really know it, then we can, the pain of it, we start to feel the pain of that more clearly. And then it becomes much less enchanting, you know. That's also one of the steps on the progress of the path, is the step of stage of disenchantment, yeah. As if we're coming out from under a spell, yeah. A couple other mental factors, curiosity and investigation. Mindfulness frames the experience. It holds it up for us. So, and then curiosity, this kind of interest, this that can bring some kind of buoyancy to it, allows us that investigation of states. We can use that to really know the experience more fully, know the surround of it. Over time, once again, not in our time frame, in the time frame of practice, as that will happen. The precepts so useful in the path, part of that sila, that first third of the Noble Eightfold Path, sila, samadhi, and panya. Samadhi, the meditation practice, the concentration, the gathered, collected mind. Panya, the wisdom that develops out of that. And we start with this foundation of sila. The precepts, Spirit Rock, they updated their precepts for online retreats. But I don't think there's anything about these precepts that is specific to or exclusive to retreat practice. So I just wanted to read these and go over them with you. And it starts, each precept starts with the language of, I undertake the training to refrain from, which is the formal, the traditional way that the precepts were written and how they've been translated. Some people don't like that refrain from language. You can use some of this positive language if you prefer. I actually, for myself at this point, somehow there are times where I've had some sense of, boy, if there were like an absence of wanting to cause harm in the mind and heart, oh, how beautiful would that be, right? And times when there was very little of that, and not only times when there was very little of that, times when there was very little of that, and I knew that there was very little of it. I was there for it, so it stuck a little bit more. And yet, so these precepts have both. The first precept, I undertake the training to refrain from harming living beings. During this retreat, I undertake the intention to bring awareness to the ways in which my judgments, anger, fear, and self-centeredness may diminish and harm myself and others. And now here's the positive part, or the positive languaging at least. I undertake the intention to cultivate compassion and care in my thoughts, words, and actions towards self and others. The second precept, I undertake the training to refrain from taking that which is not freely offered. During this retreat, I undertake the intention to bring awareness to the way I use resources and to cultivate a spirit of simplicity. Another thing we could do with the second precept is we could see, for those of us who are white in this group, we could see our white privilege. And do, we can't get rid of our white privilege, but we can work to dismantle that, to erode that, to take action to bring others up to the same level as us. If we're men, we can do that for women and for people of other genders. For cisgender, we can do that for people regardless of their gender identity. So on and so forth with all of these categories. So the second precept, to refrain from taking that which is not freely offered. Additionally, I will bring awareness to ways that I try to control my environment, manipulate situations to get my way, and to put demands on the people around me. And then the language of more some of the action that we will do as opposed to the action that we won't. I undertake the intention to cultivate kindness and generosity and to allow those around me the safety of choice. The third precept, I undertake the training to refrain from sexual misconduct. During this retreat, I undertake the intention to bring awareness to my sexual energy and to the ways an unwise relationship to this energy can cause suffering for others. And then action that we can directly do as opposed to refrain from. I undertake the intention to cultivate responsibility and respect for my commitments and for the commitments of others. So notice with that precept, it doesn't say you have to be in a monogamous relationship. That's not at all the case. But you don't want to be using your sexuality in a way that causes harm for yourself or others. The fourth precept, I undertake the training to refrain from harsh and harmful speech. During this retreat, I undertake the intention to practice limited noble silence, bringing awareness to how much and when I choose to speak. To the best of my ability, I will refrain from engaging in idle chit-chat, gossip, arguing, and complaining. And then what we can actually do, I undertake the intention to cultivate kind, truthful, timely speech, and deep listening. The fifth precept, I undertake the training to refrain from careless consumption of intoxicants. The traditional one, and traditionally this, the Pali words are Sura, Marya, and Majapahamdana. Those were three alcoholic beverages of the time of the Buddha. I undertook the intention to be mindful of my consumption and overconsumption of food, alcohol, and other intoxicants and entertainment. And then I like this as well. I have thought of this often with this, the precepts here. I will bring care to how much I engage with social media, listening to and reading the news, and watching television. I undertake the intention to cultivate a healthy diet, good physical health, and clarity of mind. So now we just need to remember to use these practices as we go about our daily lives, involved in social justice work and taking action in the world. I do think that it's important for us to take that action in the world. When doing this, we can urge or push for change. We can make the case for the unsatisfactoriness of the status quo, as so many people are doing, which I think is really wonderful. As we're doing this, as we're going about this in the world, as we're going to our protests, trying to get laws changed, trying to have police forces changed, can we do this and still hold all beings in our hearts without casting any beings out of our hearts? Yeah. You know, maybe not to start. Maybe to start, we can't do that. That's too far outside our scope. But maybe we can do that in small ways or for brief periods. I'm remembering Thich Nhat Hanh during the Vietnam War, after somebody had done something and he wanted to respond to it, but he was too angry. He had too much anger in his heart and he did not want to respond from this place of anger. So he went out and did walking meditation, just walked in silence for like 2 weeks or something, and then he could talk. That's some of the depth of commitment to practice that he had. From the place of the reactive mind, which we all have reactive mind, at least as near as I can tell, we all do. I certainly do. My guess is that some of you, I know this of you specifically, others of you, I don't, but you may or may not. But from that place of the reactive mind, as you know, we're more likely to do unwholesome or unskillful action, right? Akusala action is the Pali word. And from the responsive mind, there we have choice, right? That's where we have our measure of choice, our intention, how we wish to continually re-aim ourselves. Where's our North Star in this moment, and then in this moment, and in this one? I want to read a little bit more from this discourse here. So the Buddha continues on, and if the monastics develop this virtue and this concentration and deepen in their practice, then they will abide pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. That means one quarter of the world. Likewise, the second, likewise, the third, likewise, the fourth. So above, below, around, and everywhere. And to all as to oneself. One abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. And then you know what comes next. One abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with compassion. The second quarter, third quarter, fourth quarter. And to all as to oneself, one abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with compassion, with a mind imbued with sympathetic joy, with a mind imbued with equanimity. And then he continues on and how the final liberation is possible, and here's how you'll know it. And then it says, and it's interesting because there was a non-Buddhist there, and usually, oftentimes in the discourses, these these other people, lay people or non-Buddhists are spoken of. They often come to the Buddha with a question or something like that, or they're in conversation with him. But in this case, it just mentions all of a sudden. Now, on that occasion, the Brahmin, Sundarika Bharadvaja, was sitting not far from the Blessed One. Then he said to the Blessed One, "But does Master Gotama go to the Bahuka River to bathe?" The Buddha says, "Why, Brahmin, go to the Bahuka River? What can the Bahuka River do?" And the Brahmin says, "Master Gotama, the Bahuka River is held by many to give liberation. It is held by many to give merit, and many wash away their evil actions in the Bahuka." Then the Blessed One, the Buddha, addressed the Brahmin Sundarika Bharadvaja in stanzas. And he lists all of these rivers that were held to be sacred rivers, Bahuka and Adikaka, Gaya and Sundarika too, Payaga and Sarasati, and the stream Bahumati. "A fool may there forever bathe, yet will not purify dark deeds. What can Sundarika bring to pass? What the Payaga? What the Bahuka? They cannot purify an evildoer, someone who has done cruel and brutal deeds." This was something that in Hinduism, purification, there were these rites that you could do for purification. But the Buddha is saying, no, that's not how you purify. This is how you purify. One pure in heart has evermore the feast of spring, the holy day. The feast of spring, I think these were Buddhist holidays, days of practice, right? The holy days were the Uposatha days, the days of the fortnight when even lay people could practice or could engage in practice all day long. One fair in act, one pure in heart, brings their virtue to perfection. It is here, Brahman, that you should bathe, to make yourself a refuge for all beings. And if you speak no falsehood, nor work harm for living beings, nor take what is offered not, with faith and free from avarice, what need for you to go to the Gaya River? For any well will be your Gaya. So, how does purification come about? Not from the rivers that you bathe in, right? Not from rituals, but from purifying that mind heart, that river of consciousness of the mind heart, that continuous steady stream. So that as we purify the cloth of our own minds and hearts, our cloth will be able to take on the dye of kindness, the dye of compassion, the dye of generosity, all of these dyes, whichever dyes you want. As we purify this cloth, we'll be able to take in all of those dyes more and more fully so that we can act in the world. Thank you for your attention. Are there any questions or comments? Jan, did you want to speak? You're not on mute, but you don't have to be. Okay. Well, let's do our... Corey, did you want to say something, or somebody wants to say something?
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you. You know, sometimes I really struggle and suffer when I see, when I'm practicing mindfulness and I see the ill will that arises. When I'm going through life throughout the day and also when I compare myself to teachers, you know, and think, oh, they're doing, wow, you know, why can't I be there? So this was really helpful and sort of reframing mindfulness, you know, in conjunction with compassion again. I mean, I've heard this 100 times, but, you know, it's sometimes it's just joined and sometimes, anyway, it just really nice to just remember, oh yeah, compassion, curiosity, non-judgment, that that's all embedded in mindfulness. It's not like those are separate practices. That's how you bring mindfulness. You don't bring mindfulness and then go, oh, now let me go practice compassion. You know, that's kind of got to be embedded. So thank you.